Today's program was brought to you by Union Beer Distributors. For more information, visit unionbeerdist.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hey, welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. Hey, I'm Jimmy Carboni from Jimmy's Number 43 and the Good Beer Seal. This is a special show. It's December 5th, 2017. We'll be talking about farmhouse breweries, and I've got some friends coming from Portland, Oregon, Wolves and People, but they're on their way. And right now, our other guest, Josh Bernstein, one of my favorite beer writers, is in the house.
Oh, hey.
All right, man. We're going to talk a little bit about what he's been writing about and what's going on in the beer scene in the area. And a big shout out to Union Beer Distributors, supplier of world-class ales and lagers. And follow us at @beer_sessions. There's a nice Instagram photo of Wolves and People when they first came here 2 years ago with Travel Portland at hanging out at McSorley's. So that's cool. So, Josh, great to see you, man. I was really proud of your recent article in the Times. It was about brews and coffee.
Yeah,
that was pretty cool.
Two kinds of buzzes. Yeah, the idea was that, so I was traveling out in Flint, Michigan about 3 months ago doing another story, and I was at a brewery called Tenacity. I noticed they just opened up a roastery and a coffee shop in there, and I was like, that's a really interesting thing. So folks could roll up there at 7 a.m., get a donut made down the road, get a great coffee made with beans roasted on site. And so then the more I started thinking about that, I started looking around the country, and I noticed this was not an outlier. There was this sort of a movement. Modern Times in San Diego is really pushing it forward. Canning cold brew, having a coffee program in the brew house. You're watching, like, who? And then I wrote the story. As a writer, you write stories and you totally forget exactly what you've written 2 weeks later. But then, Hoof Hearted in Columbus is doing that as well. And what I think this moment happens about is you have these tap rooms and then you get people in there at noon, 1, 2, 3 o'clock, and that's great. But what happens in this space at 8 a.m.? So it's a way to get people in the breweries earlier in the day. And it's a way that you've got this canning line you spend a ton of money on. And then if you can coffee, you have a way to sort of maximize your money on there too. And there's really a big crossover between the coffee world and the beer world. If you like a good cup of coffee, chances are you like a good cup of beer. I mean, you like flavor. That's what you're kind of hunting out.
Great, man. Well, Josh, I really appreciate the work you're doing, as always. And check it out, great New York Times article that Josh just wrote. But everyone else is in the room now, so we're kind of going to start the show all over again.
I was
again.
A filler. Just filler. Wow. I was like, just talk.
Hey. So, guys, let's go around. So everyone introduce themselves. With Tim, we're starting over. So,
okay. Yeah.
Oh, hey, I'm Josh Bernstein. I just filled up the last 3 minutes of radio silence as Jimmy stared at me.
All right.
Well done. I'm Christian DiBenedetti. We just jumped out of a cab and been visiting the city for the last few days. And
great. I was just saying that the last time I saw you, you were out with the Travel Portland crew with Commons and Gigantic and Occidental Brewing. And we did a show, and we did a photo at McSorley's, which is on Instagram right now. That was pretty great.
Yeah.
But I'm so proud of you with Wolves and People, and we're going to talk a lot about that and farmhouse breweries on the show today. And you brought along one of your new buddies.
That's right. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I'm Evan Watson of Plan B Farm Brewery. And it turns out there are a lot of people in this city you got here, Jimmy. Well, it took us a little bit to come in, but thanks for covering, Josh.
Yeah, do what I do. Saying right. Words.
Well, welcome. Welcome back, Christian and Evan too. Christian, I know you've been a journalist, and that's how I knew you, and Josh knows you. But I really want to talk more about Wolves and People, the farmhouse aspect of your brewery. So,
okay.
Tell us about it. I know it's a family farm. You grow like hazelnuts.
Yeah. So, Wolves and People is a farmhouse brewery based on the farm where I grew up, which is outside of Portland, Oregon, 21 miles from town. And after a lot of years of just talking about it and dreaming about it, I went home. I had lived in New York for 9 years, moved out in the end of 2009 to start getting organized. And then 2016, in May, we opened up the brewery. And really small, still, we're out in the wine country, and a lot of people come to visit us who are also visiting wineries, and we focus on saison, sour beers, wood aged beers, and a lot of beers that, you know, fall under that farmhouse kind of banner, if you will. And we grow a lot of things that go in the beer, so from Dilbert's to figs and plums and this and that. And so I'm here this week to introduce beer to New York. We shipped out a whole pallet of beer, and so in the next 4 weeks, there's going to be some beer going on draft and in bottle shops.
So does it feel like you've kind of come full circle? That, you know, you left town as a beer writer, you come back as a brewer.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of surreal in a way to go. I went into the Blind Tiger, which is a place I love and spent a lot of time in over the years, and to go in there and have some. To have some beer there, and it's just like, it's, oh, that's going to be a little bit of a gusher. I hope that's not too big of a problem. It feels good though. I learned a lot about beer here in the city, you know, and great beer friends.
Yeah.
And beer friends in the industry, and a lot of people who supported me over the years and then helped me get going as a beer writer. So it's nice to be back. And, you know, there's so much cool stuff going on here. I haven't been here for 2 years, and it's like a different beer scene almost.
Just a quick mention of the beers. I'm drinking what's on tap at Roberta's right now, the Melvin IPA. They always have a great selection of beer on draft, and I'm enjoying that.
And we're drinking the Rockaway Brewing Helles.
Great.
It's good.
And then, Evan, so, you know, so you guys are kind of in the category of farmhouse breweries.
Yeah.
You guys, it's funny because I think that Christian knows everybody in New York, but you haven't been here for what, 5 years or something?
I left in the end of 2009, so, man, yeah, I'm getting old.
So, so you guys met actually through, what, some conference?
Yes, we did, Jimmy. The National Honey Board hosted, they generally host a conference for brewers.
I just wanted to hear you say that, man. Say that again, please.
The National Honey Board? That part?
Yeah.
Okay. I was going to make a joke that Josh better watch out, and he better stay in the city or you're going to come back a brewer.
God. Is that a good thing? I think it's a good thing, right?
No, it's a terrible thing.
Is it terrible?
Yeah. No, it's a good thing. We met in Austin, Texas. Generally, the National Honey Board provides a conference for brewers and bakers in St. Louis. Is that right, Christian?
That sounds right.
But they, I guess they had befriended the folks at Jester King Brewery, another one of our iconic farmhouse breweries in the United States. And we met and hit it off. Christian was spinning yarns around the bar. We had some cocktails and talked about how with a single stroke of the pen, he took down the entire Orval Empire.
That's a real stretch. That is definitely a stretch. I probably... I might have embellished a little bit, but
no, it was a great story about Christian's obviously a writer before, and we were both
one of your first articles, right?
It was
fans of
was
Orval, and it was just a funny.
Well, let's go to the visual. You guys look like farmers now, Christian. You left a kind of a fancy New York writer, and now you both have like the flannel plaid shirts.
They're only
on.
Wearing flannel, Jimmy.
Yeah.
You both have like country
it's cold
twang.
Outside.
It was a sweaty cab ride over here. I'll tell you that with all the flannel in the back.
what can I say? Like, it's been beautiful since I've been here and not cold and rainy, which is nice. I mean, being here and being back and then seeing the beer scene and going around, I've been to so many cool spots in the last 2 days, and the beer lists are pretty much unrecognizable to me from new breweries. We just paused at Threes for a hot second, and before that I was visiting, you know, like Proletariat and all these great new As Is, all these other beer bars in town that are doing neat stuff. So it's been great to be back, like super, super fun.
Great. Let's go back. So Wolves and People, Josh has a lot of questions for you. We're going to be talking for a long time. But, Wolves and People is your family farm. It sounds very old world to me. I picture like another idyllic time where, you know, you went off out into the world and you went back home. And tell us about that journey and when you decided that that was what you're going to do, have a farmhouse brewery on your family farm.
Yeah, I mean, I really always wanted to do this. And from my travels in Belgium back after college, I was lucky to spend some time in Europe and, you know, visiting cool old breweries, lambic breweries, the wild ale breweries that are so revered today. And I wanted to, you know, take my, you know, very, very basic home brewing skills someday and do my own brewery. But I hadn't really put two and two together about, you know, a farmhouse actually using the barn, for example, on our farm as the place for the brewery. I had imagined some more modern building or something. And then after touring around in Belgium and realizing, wait, we have an old barn and maybe that's perfect. So, but then it was 20 years of time before I could get it really get it open. And it took a long time, a lot of organization, raising money, obviously, transitioning from being working travel and beer writer to running a brewery. It was, frankly, a really hard transition, you know, but I had a lot of support. And back in 2000, so about 12, 13, found an old brew house, the old Heater Allen system. They're a great lager brewery, and they were expanding. So managed to get a down payment together and then just start getting organized. And then I've been really lucky to work with some excellent people, great brewers, taught me everything I know now. And a year ago, we opened, a year and a half ago, with about 8 or 9 beers. And since then, we've released about 70, 75 beers, about half a dozen, in package, in bottles and cans. And I have one full-time assistant. And that's it. So we're tiny, but trying to grow a little bit and experiment and have fun.
You know, opening up on your family property has all these sort of romantic connotations. You're continuing this generational thrust, but opening up on an old property has its own challenges. What was it like turning the family farmstead into a sort of functioning brewery?
Yeah, I mean, I never knew how much I would have to learn from weird YouTube videos about like how to deal with septic and, you know, all the kind of hack construction that we had to do. I mean, the barn is leaning over. It was built in 1912 and it's on the National Historic Registry as well. So you can't really change the appearance, but we had to go inside and kind of from the inside out, upgrade the interior to reach the seismic code so it's safe to work in and have customers in. And that was an education. And, it's really like the pushing the rock up the hill thing, because one day we would learn, it seemed like we would finish some project, some challenge, and then learn what else that is still out there. And so it's kind of still ongoing. The barn feels like kind of like a member of our family now, and we're working on it and, you know, getting it up to speed and opening up new little parts of it and improving it as we go.
Nice. And Evan, you guys also took over, and it wasn't family property, but you took over an old facility in Poughkeepsie and turned that into sort of
your
dream
homework.
Too. Yeah, I have. I interviewed you years ago. You totally forget.
That's right. Yeah. When you used to interview porn stars.
I did. That was like 01.
See, I've done my homework as well.
But you did take over. It was an old farm.
Yes, sir. It was the original farming population, family farm, 500 acres total, not our farm. Our petition is 25 acres, but the Underhill family had 5 large farms, and they fed the Queen City, of Poughkeepsie, New York. And as development grew and urban sprawled and cul-de-sacs moved in, strangely, this little part of in the back of Poughkeepsie was left alone. And we were able to get a piece of property for very little money, but then had to put in all infrastructure, all kind of electric, and tore down a house from the early 1800s that had a tree growing through it. The 5-bedroom prize of the farm, but we had to take it down, and we've done a lot of work, mainly renovating a barn from the mid 1800s. It's 3 stories, and when there was a fire in the house, the last resident had moved out to the barn. He was a crazy Irishman off the boat named John, who used to run into town naked. Our current mayor, Rob, was a police officer at the time. The first time he came up to see the brewery, he's like, oh yeah, we used to drop off crazy John nude in the back of my police car into this barn.
So when are you going to make the crazy John beer?
I don't know. Her beers.
Well, then how about this? So what, is there something about making beer on a farm that's different than making beer in a city?
Oh, certainly, yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, as he said, I mean, the infrastructure thing is a challenge. Get over that. Start making beer. You got to have a system that works for you and place to put all the, you know, the boring stuff, the wastewater and all those things. But the thing that I love most about our situation is the closeness that we have to the stuff we're growing on the farm and then what we can get locally. So, for example, there's a farmer up the road. Her place is called Sunshower Hill, and someone who actually came and played with my brothers and I when we were little kids. And you know, we don't remember each other, but she you know came as a kid, and she came to the brewery one day and said, "Hey, you know, I used to come here. Now I have my own little organic farm up the hill, and here's what I have. Let me give you a list of the things that I have." and a lot of things that we don't grow. And now we keep in close touch, and she'll just call and say, hey, you know what? I've got, you know, four flats of golden raspberries. Do you want to take a look? And then let's just bring them down, you know, and it's always beautiful. So we just incorporate that as soon as we possibly can.
And are some of those things in this beer? I taste like a lavender or herbaceous lemon quality.
You know, this beer actually is it's a Saison aged in gin barrels.
Oh.
And herbaceous, so that's, yeah. It's the herbs, yeah. It's definitely the...
botanicals?
The botanicals, yeah.
What's the name of the beer, Christian?
So we
don't have names.
Yeah, well, no, it does. This beer we call Ginstinctive. Instinctive Travels is our first Saison that we brought out when we first opened, and we've made it in multiple iterations. And then one day we parked a full batch in a bunch of gin barrels from Ransom Distillery, which is a distillery near us, an incredible operation that's been around for a long time.
Their Old Tom is terrific.
Yeah, Old Tom gin is something everyone should seek out if they're interested. So it's been about a year in oak. This one has a funny label on it because it was sort of labeled for some of our Cellar Society backers, crowdfunding backers. But we're bringing the beer back in a larger or a normal batch.
And then Evan, for you, yes. You know, again, making beer on the farm.
Oh, it's like people say, I love your Instagram account. And I have like my buddy Derek, who you've had on the podcast, Dillinger, is actually a great
Ken
photographer,
Falls, yeah.
Yeah, and a great photographer, great writer, just like you guys. Well, you know, something like you guys, but he takes actual photographs of his farm with a real you know DSLR or whatever. I don't know anyone.
Not just a flip cam.
Yeah, so I'm just using my phone. But what happens is. Like I just, it's not stainless steel and cement. So like, I just take a picture of what I'm existing in constantly, which is perpetually inspirational. And I, you know, in having access to the ingredients and just like taking a break from mashing in and just walking through my field of winter rye that's coming up really great right now. I was like, I don't know. It's relaxing. It's inspirational from ingredient base, but also in terms of a sense of place and feeling. Yeah,
that's awesome. Great start. I'm glad you guys made it in time for the show. Great start to this. We'll be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
Let's do it.
In 1996, Sheehan Family Companies, formerly L. Knife & Son, acquired Union Beer Distributors, which was originally located on Union Avenue in Brooklyn. Union Beer has since expanded to its present location alongside the English Kills Canal in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. It has grown dramatically in the last decade as the primary distributor of Anheuser-Busch products for Brooklyn and parts of Queens through the hiring and development of the best people in the industry. In 2003, Union Beer acquired a powerful catalog of specialty brands, which immediately positioned them as the craft beer supplier to accounts in Manhattan, Brooklyn, Queens, the Bronx, Staten Island, and Long Island. Union perpetually tweaks their portfolio to maintain the highest level of stylistic breadth with the most coveted brands available. Through the highest possible level of service, outstanding salesmanship of the ultimate lineup of brands, and a paramount focus on education at all levels, Union Beer has solidified its position as the only source for the best selection of beers in the seven counties of southeastern New York. For more information, visit unionbeerdist.com.
Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. Hey, last night we had a great Heritage Radio Network first annual fundraiser at Brooklyn Botanical Garden. Thanks to everybody. It was really great turnout. I want to give a big shout out to one of our co-hosts and buddies, Chris Kuzme of Ferment About It. His fifth Hammer Brewery in Queens is open, and he served a honey brown ale that was really great and sessionable. So that's an intro to Josh wanted to ask a question about hives and honey.
Yeah,
with these guys.
I think with Christian talks about like all the fruit, botanicals, everything available to him, and that's sort of his terroir, what he can incorporate into his beer. So Evan, for you, what do you kind of take from Poughkeepsie and kind of make your own?
Well, on top of growing quite a lot this year, we also are working with a farm, Poughkeepsie Farm Project, which is a part of the Vassar Brothers, Vassar College Farms. And the Vassar Brothers, Matthew Vassar, they built that city. My daughter was born in Vassar Hospital, and they were brewers, which is an interesting connection as well. But they have this beautiful farm because it's supported by the community, but also has some internal funding, government funding. It's just ideal place, and we go, and we're CSA members there, and we use a lot of their ingredients. I mean, we're currently I'm only brewing beers with malt grain grown from Ben Dobson at Stonehouse Farms near Red Hook, New York. He's done a TED talk about carbon sequestration, and he's one of our greatest organic farmers in the country. And so I use his six-row barley for all the beers now. It's floor malted by Dennis Nessel at Germantown Beer Farms. And then all the adjuncts are also
stuff know, Christian.
His grains.
Well, I'm just sitting here in awe of what Evan does at Plan B, because, I mean, to the level of commitment it takes to get floor malted barley locally. And then I hope you'll tell the story about your yeast too, because that's just so awesome. That's one of the big things we like bonded over, is talking about yeast and his whole process. So I mean, and the beers are so outstanding. So
well, you've got Sebastian, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's a plum yeast, and it's slow and lazy and idiosyncratic.
Fermenting these, Christian?
There is Sebastian in here, but the main situation in these two beers, we call amigos, and it's a house sour culture. All the dregs together.
It's fizzy like a soda. Is that because of the gin barrels, or that's
good question. You know, it's been bopping around in my backpack for about 3 hours as I made my way across town into Brooklyn. So it's part of it. But yeah, bottle conditioned and
a slow voyage.
A little bit of a voyage. And the other beer is a darker Saison. But, you know, I think it expresses a lot of, vibrancy with big carbonation, big volumes of CO2. And that comes from bottle conditioning.
And let's just go back to, I think, where Josh was going and how you guys met, talking about hives and honey.
Yeah, just curious, like how Evan, what you do is you uniquely, you know, isolate yeast strains from honey. And I guess, what are the challenges of that? And like, how do these operate differently or in the same way as maybe like an ale or lager yeast would operate?
And what do you do? I mean, you just put honey in your beer? I mean, tell us, are you making wild yeast?
It's not too far from that. I'm pretty rudimentary. My wife Emily is our beekeeper, and she goes in and extracts in the spring and in the fall, and we take a spoonful of comb and honey and propolis and all the things that are attached to a frame, and we add that to unfermented beer, to wort in a stir plate and Erlenmeyer flask. So instead of streaking and plating, which is a very scientific approach, what we're doing is this kind of very natural encouraging of what we call a mixed culture of both bacteria, wild yeast, certainly certain strands of Saccharomyces. And then from that process, we're pitching that after we cool ship. Every one of our beers is cooling in a natural process, which also adds microflora. And then it will, the beers will start out in a Hudson Valley oak horny tank, an open vessel for primary fermentation, where we take that yeast throughout the year. So then throughout the year, there's this evolution, this symphonic kind of movement between a fight of different yeast and bacteria. So not only are the beers seasonal fermentation from a fermentation perspective, but even batch to batch, there are some differences as the seasons change.
And then I remember when I was with you a year and a half ago, you actually had your cool ship, and you have a way of putting it outside, and you have orchards there. And
we have
so much going on. I mean, you have more in your farm than you're telling us. I mean, you've got apple trees.
I'm holding out on you.
Oh yeah, we can go back and listen to On the Road.
We've got goats.
They're utterly delightful.
Oh, nailed it.
Did you meet him, Josh?
I've not. Sister-in-law does goat yoga, which is a thing now.
Oh, I know. They get jump on.
She really does that?
Yeah, she does. Like, she teaches yoga around goats. It's like,
yeah, they jump. They like to jump on the backs of people, and they love. It's like a thing.
Swear to God, it's the 21st century, man. Goat yoga. It's like, what I think is truly interesting. You guys have both kind of come you know, you've come from separate backgrounds. You know, Christian did the writing, did books, did the book tour thing. Evan, you have a big music background as well, and you guys both came to sort of this same place right now. Do you guys feel like you made the right decision? Is a decision that you're happy? I mean, like, because, you know, music industry, not easy to make a buck right now. Journalism, not easy to make a buck. So you guys feel like you got out at the right time?
Oh, it's so easy to make a buck in breweries, right, Evan?
God.
Oh, so easy.
Or is it just exchanging, I guess, like one hardship for
my
the
Lamborghini
next?
Was stuck on the FDR. That's why
it almost hit me.
Yeah, I mean, no, look, running a brewery is no joke. It's hard work. And especially when you add in a 100 or 200-year-old barn, in Evan's case, you are literally, and I use the metaphor often, but it's like, you know, chasing or the Sisyphus, sort of, you know, pushing the stone uphill, it's going to roll back over you, or you're riding the wave. Some days it feels good, other days the waves are crashing on you and tumbling you, and you're you know, that's just the nature of the industry now. It's very competitive. We were the 169th brewery in Oregon to open up, and you know, so it's an exciting beer scene, but it's always changing. We don't take anything for granted. And but you know, yeah, it's an amazing change. I love
it. Let's talk about the next beer we're drinking.
Oh, okay. Next beer is a dark saison. We really love this beer. Our brewer Zach brewed this about a year ago, a year and a half ago, actually, quite a long time ago. He was an intern who started with us before we opened. And so it's a more bitter saison, some rye, you know, a bit of a darker, almost, you know, not really beer de garde, but, you know, a bigger profile of saison, parked in barrels for quite a long time, and then bottle conditioned. And this beer really took a long time to come around. The bottle conditioning was very, very slow, like 3 months. And of course, it doesn't, you know, help that the temperatures in our barn are range from, you know, 50 degrees to 100 degrees. So it's really tricky to bottle condition in there. But this is a beer that just I brought because we don't serve it outside of the brewery, and I wanted to share it with you guys. It's not something that's coming out
or touched.
No, thank you. Yes, good, good. That was the idea. So,
I mean, how do you feel about, you know, taking your time with beer? One show I'm going to have is with Anthony Accardi from Transmitter, and I remember sitting with him a year and a half ago, and he really thinks that beer needs more time, the whole process. And I think there's the pressure to turn out beer really fast.
Well, that's a perspective that's counterintuitive to the wave of beer currently, about pushing out beer. In fact, designing that in a way where the consumer is waiting outside of the door of the packaging line.
But people waited outside that farm stand for you guys too.
I suppose, yeah. That was a long time ago, though. People don't care anymore.
But that's the thing.
Were just waiting for my one juicy IPA. They were like, he's going to do one. But No,
that's the thing. You're only a darling once. I mean, it's hard to be the new kid on the block.
But still, in terms of making
Ask
the beer,
Mark
like
Wahlberg.
Like I like this beer. I'm impressed that it's a year later. I've had a lot of ciders like that have spent time in barrels without being too big or onerous. Let's really talk about that. You know, it's like there's pressure to turn out your beer and turn it fast. But even a good pils or lager does take more time in a tank.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that most of our beers are at the very earliest 3 to 5 weeks. I mean, but it's not uncommon to see beers turning around in 7 to 10 days, 14 days in the beer scene these days. And to my mind, there's so much sort of over aggressive hopping going on, and you know, I think that those beers are scratching a certain itch right now, and they can be delicious. Like I will drink one. I will drink several. Sometimes they're great. They can be great, but there's a lot of waste that goes on as well. Like when you hop a beer that heavy and crank it out in 7 or 10 days, you're losing 1, 2, 3 barrels at a time, just being soaked up by hops. And to me, that's just kind of like I don't know. I don't want to see that much beer, you know, kind of go down the drain for the sake of a sort of, you know, alcoholic, you know, like hop bomb that is really just here today, gone tomorrow. But you know, to each his own. I don't judge anyone for drinking beers that are hoppy, hazy, triple hop, double IPA, whatever. Go for it. You know, go for it. It's great.
Are
but,
you sure?
You know, it's not what.
Tell us how you really feel.
Yeah, that's how I really feel. No, I mean, but I think whatever.
I think the thing for me is that I love them as well, but oftentimes these days I'm getting ones that are so kind of green, so intense right off the bat that it's kind of hard to drink. You almost have to let them age in your house for another week to kind of get to that right point right now. But there's this sort of desire right now for freshness. But, I mean, there's a point where freshness is not always what you want to seek. You want maybe like another couple days this beer could really use to get that sort of optimal point.
Yeah, and that's why I was looking at your website today, Wolves and People, Christian.
That's a good plug, Jimmy.
And I was inspired by, you know, the tagline, ancient beers in modern times. And, you know, when I read about 19th century, you know, British brewing, which at the time was the height of world-class brewing. There was the market for it. There weren't the pressures of like wars and depressions. They were the best beers were higher alcohol but balanced with a lot of malt in them. Mm-hmm. And they also took time. These weren't beers that were knocked out for just workers to drink, you know. So let's talk more about that. It's ancient beers for modern times, but does that mean that the better beers take time?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, I think Evan would agree. But, you know, for us, mixed culture fermentation is kind of our bailiwick. We use a lot of wild yeast, some conventional yeast, a lot of yeast that we haven't even figured out yet. But those are going to be slower. You know, it's not like throwing in, you know, the most aggressive, clean sort of automatic yeast at all times. Sometimes we do beers like that. We enjoy turning out a beer that's more about malt or more about hops or some other ingredient than it is about yeast. But the most interesting thing for me personally and for our team is these beers that do take longer, that transform over time. And then particularly with bottle conditioning, one of our best known beers, Instinctive Travel, as I mentioned, is we always dry hop it differently and use a different Brett combination, switch it up every time. That beer, the current edition of it, that we're down to a few cases, but it, you know, it's been in the bottle since last March, but it's just finally hitting a place where we're like, oh God, this beer has arrived now, way later than was expected. We thought it would be hitting its prime, you know, 3 months ago. The hops are gone, the Brett's coming, and I think there's a kind of sweet spot where hops can fade and Brett comes up, and there's a sort of like nexus.
So that you do have really to nice. You have to wait on the beer.
But you aging, have to wait.
The aging is such a sorry, Evan. Go ahead.
Okay.
It's because aging is so kind of tough to figure out because even unless you're having these variables and keeping these bottles in your basement, you can only have it at 60 degrees only forever and a day. Right. Like my mom and dad saved this bottle of wine for my sister got married from the 70s, and we opened it up, and it was originally like a very supposed to age well as like a green German wine, ended up being sort of intensely like ruby red and almost port-like. And we're like, well, we missed the mark on that. There are things that are not worth saving. And I think we all don't really know. And you need to almost buy a bunch of things or even as brewers keep testing and figuring out what's the right time.
I would say the most beautiful thing about bottle conditioning is that you're starting out at a place with a lot of oxygen intentionally, because in order for re-fermentation to be healthy, and it is constantly consuming oxygen, whereas a bottle that's packaged with that's already been primed with CO2 from injection, meaning that it's just a beer that has been force carbonated, is always going to deplete. It's going to get more oxygen as it ages, whereas bottle-conditioned beers will consume that oxygen, and oxygen is the biggest enemy of aging beers. So these beers actually, you know, their foaminess is saving them and preserving them, and that could be a rule of thumb. And I mean, there's many different ways of tasting beer and storing beer, but if a beer is bottle conditioned, you can hang on to it for much longer and versus a beer that's been injected by CO2.
Even to go back to sort of commercially produced beers that I always go by, people are like, oh, what should I buy from middle of nowhere? But Sierra Nevada has such low levels of dissolved oxygen in all their beers, and they bottle condition everything, that beer is almost guaranteed beautiful no matter what. So even doing bottle conditioning for mass-produced stuff can work out in a big way.
Great. Hey, we'll take another short break. We'll be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
Don't go in for understanding when you are away. Can't use my heart to think away the time. In my room I will await you, and so soon I will relate you. And tie your finger right on up to mine. Sweet Joseph.
Hey, like what you hear? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. With fresh programming every week, we've got something for everyone. Trying to start your own food business? Concerned about where your food comes from? Looking for the best wine or beer to bring to a party? Find our shows on iTunes or Stitcher, or head to heritageradionetwork.org to listen live and subscribe to our newsletter.
Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. Hey, wolves and people are in New York City. Christian,
hey.
You brought your buddy, farmhouse buddy.
We've got bees, Evan, and wolves and
Josh Bernstein.
So, and a Bernstein bear. Bernstein
bear. I love that series.
Especially Bernstein. Bernstein bears. And they're really Christian now. And they're
honey, what's a honey? There's a honey board that you guys met through.
Yeah.
I want you guys to ask questions over there. Like, pretend we're at the honey board and you guys are farmhouse brewers. You guys are like figuring out.
Sure.
How do you guys make better beer?
It's a sticky situation, Jimmy.
Oh, my word. The puns.
Sticky situation. Yeah. Nice. Well, I will say this. Like,
thank you, John.
We want to bring a lot of honey into our situation. And we're talking to a local beekeeper or two that want to park some hives at our place. And the thing that's really cool about honey in Oregon is, you know, there are many kinds of honey, wild and indigenous honeys, clover, blackberry honeys are everywhere. But the thing in Oregon that grows is called meadow foam. And meadow foam, do you remember tasting that?
Yeah, it was crazy.
It was like a crazy, I don't know how to put it into words. It was almost like a tropical suite of aromas going on. And everyone at the tasting that we attended were kind of nodding in agreement, like, this is blowing our minds right now. And lo and behold, meadow foam is the Oregon, is an Oregon thing or Pacific Northwest thing. So I'm trying to track down meadow foam growers. We're going to plant it in our field. We have a field that's mainly full of daffodils. I'm going to try to interplant some with some meadow foam and see what happens. You know, there are bees already in the area, but getting a hive going, getting some meadow foam going will be a goal.
And let's just clarify. So when we're talking about honey and beer, like last night, Fifth Hammer, Chris Kuzme's beer, it was a honey brown ale. It's not sweet. What does the honey do? I mean, it can do what?
Well, you know, there are a lot of ways to use honey. Obviously, I'm culturing yeast from honey, which is not a very common way, but honey is a sugar, and it's a relatively simple sugar. It's easy fermentable, so I mean, people hear the word honey and they think sweet.
You think the golden taste of honey, and that screws up your conception of honey.
What's that pipes?
That's the golden. It's a Cheerio song.
Oh,
I'm trying to sing with Evan one day.
Well, your voice was so golden and honey like.
Golden taste of honey.
Nailed it.
Sweet on you,
that's my little honey.
I mean, people use it generally as an adjunct for fermentation, and it will ferment. And we looked. You remember watching those fascinating charts about like sugars and how much is fermentable, and how much maltose, how much sucrose, how much fructose is in honey, honey. Works as a drying agent, much like many people used to use. Now the only sugar used in an IPA is apparently lactose sugar, but people used to use actual refined sugar to dry out IPAs, to build alcohol and keep out of the way of a malt base to accentuate hops. That's what happens in a West Coast IPA. But the honey, it can be used in a similar way, and it has a flavor. When fermented out, it's more like a mead, more like more floral and medicinal than it is like sweet and cloying to me. And we do, because we harvest honey, we do a certain amount of beers that both are fermented with a yeast derived from honey and have a certain amount of honey from our hives.
Honey is just it's a special property. It's like, it's not like a refined sugar. It's a natural product.
Yeah.
It's good for you. There's magic to it.
It's the only thing that insects make that I love to eat that I put in my coffee.
You don't enjoy the fruit flies of fall?
No.
Oh, yeah.
Or
yeah.
A cockroach spit. Tried that.
Ooh,
one.
Oh, that's...
Remember to tell you a story about how we spent 3 months when we were 22 drinking an espresso machine filled with cockroaches.
What?
And then we didn't realize that the cockroaches had snuck into the espresso machine water thing.
Didn't McKellar make a beer like that? It was like the digested...
One day, that was Civet Cat.
Civet Cat, yeah, right.
That different animal was digesting.
You're getting orifices coffee confused, Jimmy. So. Oh my God, I don't even know what's happening with these sound effects.
Great.
It's like we're laughing.
Oh, I know.
But we also know, this is weird, but we know that in our flour that there's some amount of insects in all food production and everything. So, but you guys, when you're doing your farmhouse, the open fermentations, the cool ships. So there is an interaction with insects. It's not like this pure sterile environment, but that's good. Like, we need the insects.
Well, yeah. I mean, the any agriculture is predicated on the existence of insects that can pollinate, right? There, at one point in time on this earth, there weren't pollinators, so there wasn't a diversity of plant life, I assume, right? It was just like mushrooms, just mycelia. But yeah, the existence of pollinators, which aren't just bees, but bees do a great job, and they also make honey, which is amazing. But that's what creates all kinds of flora. And inside of that hive, they're carrying pollen, which carries microflora. And there's a great tradition of natural mead making, just diluting honey. Arguably, the first fermented beverage was a hive in a tree that was flooded, and it just naturally fermented. We talked about that, I believe.
I love that.
The bear reaches.
Although Pete Brown, his new book, Miracle Brew, he argues that actually a long time ago, people figured out how to somehow mash or malt grain.
Certainly, but I guess we were saying...
I'm just saying that because I know.
We were saying with that, the trunk anecdote with a bear or something, it was pre-hominid.
I always thought that. It's like the origin story of alcohol. I always thought that, too. They would say, you know, the deer would be eating a fermented apple, you know, off the floor.
Sure.
Well, I love the Michael Pollan line, which is to summarize it very imperfectly, I'm sure, but that we're all kind of working for the yeast. You know, that yeast is really in charge of the world and all of its processes, and we're just sort of like furthering yeast's survival through baking and brewing. But at the end of the day, we're just the ones working. They're the ancient single-cell organism that's going to be here in millions of years.
So it's pollinators and yeasts.
Fermentation, I mean, you talk about everything. You know, kimchi, we talk about beer, you talk about whatever, sake. I mean, it's all yeast driving it all.
It's what kept us alive. It's what kept civilizations alive, is fermenting their foods and preserving foods.
So with you guys, there's no bacteria that can live in honey, though, right? And that's why a jar of honey can live, like, it can be stable.
It's antibacterial, it's antimicrobial, but it doesn't necessarily mean when diluted. So what happens is in high concentration, just like salt, a high concentration of sugar will make everything static, which doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It just means that it can't grow. Right, okay. So through the dilution of that honey, you can get to a point in which there's still these organisms, microorganisms that come from honey that can be bacteria, that can survive and thrive within honey, that are from a particular bee or whatever, that can grow. And I mean, we're picking up bacteria obviously from the cool ship and in the oak. Everything I ferment everything in oak, so I mean there's bacteria. But in theory, I've never plated it because I have this. I'm just a romantic. You know.
Let's catch up a minute.
I like that.
Evan, on your beer. So we have what? First, the barn beer.
Yeah, we poured the barn beer. Oh, and this could be a talking point for the both of us. I'm sorry, Josh. I feel like you've been edged out of this conversation.
Okay, I know. I don't have any honey, even though I am the bee's knees. I think that's had their finger on the button waiting for me to say a word.
As soon as you say something.
David's professional engineer. Thank you, David.
The other beers I brought our summer beer, which that might be a pretty active one. We have a CSA similar to Christian's, and this year we did adjuncts just from the farm that represented the farm at a particular time. So the darker beer I poured is our winter beer that was dark farmhouse beer, slightly tart with chocolate mint we grew and rye barrels from a friend. And it's kind of like an Andes mint, that one. And this one that you guys are pouring is our summer beer, which we grew blacktail watermelons and apple and strawberry mint. I don't know if that's that good. I don't know. I haven't had it forever. I hope it's good.
That's good.
But they're representative of the different seasons on the farm. We did four different seasons. Autumn, we grew this heirloom maize, bloody butcher, and blue claridge, and Reed's yellow dent, and used Long Island cheese pumpkins that we grew, and toasted coriander that we grew.
What's a cheese pumpkin?
It sounds delicious. It's, you know, a bread bowl from Panera?
Uh-huh.
No, I'm kidding. It's just a pumpkin that looks like a cheese wheel on the exterior. It has kind of a waxy coating, and it's like that orange yellow, and it's formed.
The great New York pumpkin, that the flesh is what pumpkin pie was about. It kind of got because it's still misshapen, so it doesn't work well with commodity production. Doesn't roll down our conveyor belt.
Yeah,
there's some seed savers on Long Island that are.
It grew amazingly, and we still have some. And it was it's a delicious pumpkin.
It looks
it's
like a big giant wheel of cheese
I've ever eaten.
So is that what Evan's kind of talking about is that in the I think the Hudson Valley we've got this sort of like this number of breweries are really embracing the local bounty and bringing sort of this idea of agrarian brewing back to New York State. So Christian, you know what's happening in Oregon as well. What type of things are you seeing out there too? Do you find sort of I see in New York State you have a lot of like-minded people together that are really coalescing because you have you know Sloop Brewing, you've got you know Suarez, people that are really sort of thinking about how New York State can be embodied in their beer. So do you see things like that happening around you in Oregon?
Yeah, that's a good question. I would say that for farmhouse brewing, you know, from our perspective, things are, you know, we're really just kind of standing on the shoulders of giants because of Logsdon, an international reputation for farmhouse brewing started in Hood River and then Agrarian down near Eugene, great brewery. We're only the third farmhouse brewery that I can really think of that is on an active and working farm. But what you have now, in many places, is a move towards micro maltings, towards Oregon-grown grains. Oregon State University kind of getting behind a lot of seed culture and seed, growing programs. And we're not quite there yet. I mean, there's a long way to go. We don't have a maltings in the Willamette Valley yet. We'd love to see that. I'm very jealous of all the maltings that are going on up in Washington and New York, other parts of the country. There are people working on it. Our maltings and the local barley that we're getting is from Eastern Oregon, and we're not able to use it full time yet, but there's some really good stuff coming out. And I would say the conversation in Oregon is all over the map. I mean, we have so many breweries, so many trends moving at once. Portland, obviously, driving the scene with almost 100 breweries in the city. But things are changing there as well. So I would say we're just really glad to be part of a kind of farm to, you know, fermenter movement that is, really focused on local as possible when we can, and pushing those relationships and developing those relationships.
So do you guys see yourself as more part of the broader conversation of farmhouse brewing in America and around the world, or more about sort of indicative of Oregon and like how you can take this and that?
Well, oh gosh. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I really feel like we're still a small and local brewery. The fact we're sending beer out to the East Coast is very exciting for us and means that we're the first time we're selling beer outside of the state of Oregon, or really outside of the Willamette Valley. So, and again, that's just because I love New York City.
Let's talk about distributing locally.
Okay.
So who do you sell to in your area? You mentioned small restaurants.
So yeah, restaurants, one of the things we have coming up this year is a lot of collaborations with local chefs. I would personally, I love food. My wife loves food. We grew up in food-loving families, and Portland's food scene is world-class. It's an incredible situation right now. And going for many, many years. So, you know, James Beard was from Portland. And so it's no surprise that the scene there is amazing. So one of the things I've been working on is like these collaborations with local chefs for 2018, which are a bunch of different beers where the chef is really going to sort of nudge us in a certain direction. So one of the chefs I love working with is a guy named Peter Cho. His restaurant, Han Oak, is absolutely blowing up and known across the country now. He's a Korean family, and he and his wife and kids live above the restaurant. And he and I gave him some beer for an event, and he liked it so much we started talking about a collaboration. And now we want to make a sort of toasted rice lager of some kind, which is not really a farmhouse style beer, but it's going to be something that we can present hopefully to his guests. And then we started thinking about what else can we do, and you know, we have these kind of kooky experiments in mind. But beyond that, we're working with other chefs that are doing incredible work in Portland to, you know, build the scene. And I envision a lot of work with restaurants as well. I just think beer is a great food pairing.
And you said something about being the third handle.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'd rather
that was a great quote, but I don't.
Well, what I meant is that, you know, there are so many amazing beer bars in the world, right? You can go in beer bars, bottle shops with thousands of choices, an overwhelming choice. But for me personally, I guess I would rather be the third handle in a nice little restaurant than the 1,000th beer in a bottle shop, which may or may not get the attention that we hope it deserves.
Cheers to that. And that's the kind of place I like to go. Cheers. What about you, Evan, for places. That are you selling in New York now too?
We do our barn beer, our little barn beer we had at first, and through Union and CBG, we distribute that down in the city and some in Massachusetts as well. I just think it's like a good calling card. I mean, both Christian and I are dependent on people coming to the space because that's the experience. And if you make good beer like he does, and hopefully like we do, it gets people to make the trek up from the city and come up to the farm and sit by the fire and wash their hair the next morning in the shower and smell a little bit of that fire and remember that. So it just helps us get... it magnetizes people to the farm and to the brewery, and it functions as that more than it functions in any capacity as a money, as a revenue stream. We're definitely on-site consumption first as a place, because that's what we're building, this experience, not just a beer.
You know? Do you think it helps being so close to population centers? Like, you're close to New York City, where you've got 8.5 million, 19 million metro, 60 million tourists a year, Christian being so close to Portland, Oregon. And do you find that this sort of proximity to giant metropolitan areas really helps make this business vision of people wanting to get out on the weekend, do something different, and go up there?
Of course.
Yeah.
I'll never forget our second weekend when I'd made some calls to the local wine tour operators. Be like, you know, can't really deal with the long, like, you know, giant buses full of wine tourists. We can't have anyone intoxicated. You know, we're trying to keep things under wraps. Our second weekend, someone goes, "You better go outside, dude." And I walk out there, and there was a pink Humvee, limo. Like
was
a 40
Augie Carton?
Yeah.
He?
No. Does he have a pink
I'm
Humvee?
I'm just kidding. No.
It was but it was like a pink Humvee limousine full of people just spilling out of the, you know. And so, like, okay, that's a reality of being in wine country and being close to a major city where, like, there are things happening, there's tourism happening. You know, people fly helicopters to wineries now in the Oregon wine country. That's not our scene. You know, we're not doing that, but I think that it does help, to go back to what Josh said, is we definitely draw from the Portland market. But our bread and butter and our local fans are what keeps the lights on, and we appreciate that.
Well, let's go through, just review the beers that we've tasted so that we keep track. So, Evan, just again.
I brought a barn beer.
Barn. It's like the national honey board for me. Barn beer.
Barn beer.
Barn beer.
Yeah, so like sound like Sam, what's his name? Sam.
Waterson?
Yeah, Waterson.
Is that right? Yeah. Or, no, that's the guy from. Okay. What were the beers you brought, Christian?
Barn beer. And this one, though. What's this one?
Oh, and we brought our winter and our.
Yeah. I wanted to say this. Okay. Talking about this kind of dark beer, there's a hint of whatever mint. It reminds me of a very Belgian beer years ago. It's a Belgian San Diego collaboration, had this kind of taste where it was dark base.
I don't know if that's a compliment.
It's like chewing winter mint gum while drinking a double.
Yeah, no, it's an Andes mint.
This is the kind of winter beer that I would like to drink. Again, it's the Plan B.
What? So
winter.
I like this beer. I don't like all my beers or most of them. I'm very critical, but
I don't either, man.
Yeah, nailed it.
Give me some with fruit floating in it. How about that?
There you go. But the this winter beer, I kind of like, but I feel like you'd have to present it as like your Swiss great grandmother would bring it as some kind of like, this isn't
no,
beer.
It's like the Lemise. It's okay. Green Flash and Saint Fulian.
Okay, whatever.
Every year they do a collaboration. Way back, classic Belgians making beer in America came out like this, and that's a compliment to you. So
thank you.
This could be like, you know, stored in a cask around a Saint Bernard's.
That's
neck,
what I'm
I
saying.
Think.
Like it's not beer. They're just like, oh, what do you make it from? They're like, we squeeze dirt and mint together.
And then Christian, for you, just review the beers that you brought.
Yeah, so we brought a Instinctive Travel Saison aged in Ransom gin barrel. So that beer is going to come to life in February, we hope. We're packaging it next week. And the bottle we had here is a bit of a pilot for that. The other beer was a dark Saison that we anecdotally just call VP4. But it is, it's about a sort of almost like a Flanders red style, if you will, that kind of like, you know, a little tannic, a little woody red. It's a little bitter and a lot sour. That's something we really enjoy. And a beer that, as I was saying before, shows just how long sometimes you have to wait for a beer. You know, like 3 months of bottle conditioning. And we're just going to wait until it's ready.
Will these be in New York?
Well, Ginsengtive, yep. That will, I hope, make it out here.
I love that beer.
And then, Josh, on the way in, we were joking about, you know, what you'd recommend for Thanksgiving or a holiday dinner. But I think a couple of these two darker winter beers, I would take them over many other beers.
Would you, Jimmy?
I would.
Would you take them over?
Well, I don't know.
Name names.
That green flash beer you was talking about.
A pills or, you know. I do think, one thing I love about this show, especially with the holidays coming, and people talk about pairings, you know, for food. There's not a lot of real good pairings for beer in the holidays.
I think any beer goes well with the holidays. Good God.
But you want to say that. You want to say pills and IPA that everyone's drinking. But what I'm saying is these two kind of darker,
sure,
you know, fall, winter styles that have some, you know, life to them. These are the kind of beers that I would drink at my holiday table.
But I think with the holidays, you're talking about and going back to the fact you have more time to contemplate and just sit back. And these are beers you need in your cup. You have a good few seconds with them. You think about them. You're not just like ordering one after the other. That's why these beers work well in the holidays. It's not really about flavor profiles. Yeah. I think I'm really against saying this beer is only good in the summer and this beer is only good in the winter. It's really when you want to drink this beer, this beer. And so I think these beers really, if you've got time, you can think about them. And that's what's really important about these beers, because not every beer should be sort of like, you know, 15 minutes, pint down, glass over, glass filled.
Well, also, because once, you know, you're with certain relatives and you learn to hold your tongue. So you better have
a beer like this to keep your tongue.
It's been a long process, but I need a beer like this for my Christmas table.
When your relatives start talking about creationism, you're just going to break out the bourbon.
Oh boy.
Maybe much more about how bad Jimmy is and kind of behavior I have at the table. But
Well, the thing I love about this beer, Evan, is like it tastes like Fernet. And I, sure, a little bit, if I may say, Fernet is kind of my go-to aperitif or, you know, digestive beer, you know, or drink, you know, after
that
a big
English?
Dinner. Yeah, it was not. Digestive drink after a big meal.
And last thing, so Christian, you're here in New York. Evan, a couple places in New York that you really liked going to for our listeners.
Oh, well, yeah, I love, you know, the Blind Tiger. You know, we dropped some samples off at Proletariat, and we're getting samples over to a lot of great beer bars. So As Is.
You mentioned As Is on the west side, yeah.
And dropped a sample at 11 Madison Park just to see what happens. You know, maybe they'll like it, maybe they won't. But, you know, we're trying to be in a few good spots where people really care about beer. And we visited Threes today. That was super cool. I hadn't been out there before. So, yeah, it's nice to be back. I think we don't make very much beer. So if we can be in five or six great New York spots, that would be real.
And you guys have time to stay and have a pizza with me at Roberta's?
I think we could.
All right. Josh, anything else you want to say?
Don't you have a book coming out?
Yeah, Jimmy didn't even talk about my book at all, but it's okay. I got a new book called Homebrew World, where basically the world doesn't need another book about how to homebrew. But what I really love is the people, passion, creativity, struggle. And the book is sort of based upon these homebrew tours I've done in New York City, where you go inside people's kitchens, you go into their backyards, go into their basements, and you're drinking beer with them. So what I did was, it's a series of profiles of brewers from a colonel in the Thai army trying to create a homebrew revolution in Thailand, to people in Poland using smoked herring, to people in Patagonia using indigenous hops. And it's really about the people and how they're kind of creating their own revolution and their own scenes all around the world right now. So I just went to the printer last week, and it's going to be dropping in April.
Sounds awesome. Congrats. And we'll have you back on and talk more about it.
Yes, we'll talk about that, Jimmy.
And then how many? And then we can talk about all your friends who started out with your homebrew tours who are now pro brewers too. That's big shout out. So again, you brought in Rockaway Brewing beer to start, and he started as a home brewer. Who's the brewer there now?
Ray Gerard's head brewer there, and Zavi is sort of the second in command. And they're both great New York City home brewers. And I think it's like a coda about this. Like, New York City doesn't have a lot of people that came from elsewhere to make their mark. What we have going in New York City and New York State is brewers that grew up here in the homebrew scene, and they decide to take a risk and make their city a better place to drink. And you see that around New York City, Hudson Valley, Long Island, that it's all homegrown here, and very little sort of mercenaries with $5 million that are just like, oh, I'm going to make beer people want to buy.
Wow, man. This has been a great show. Big thanks to Josh Bernstein, Christian DiBenedetti, Evan Watson for joining me here on the Heritage Radio Network. Thanks to our sponsor, Union Beer Distributor, supplier of world-class ales and lagers. And a big shout-out. Everybody has been a supporter of me and Jimmy's number 43. We're figuring things out for next year, but keep listening to the show. We got some great holiday shows coming up the next 2 weeks. And big shout-out to our producer, Justin Kennedy, engineer David Tadashur. We'll catch you next time on Beer Sessions Radio. All right. Woo!
Woo!
Buddies, yeah. Cool.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.